On today's show, I speak with Evan Le Espiritu Gandhi about two path-breaking studies which create new ways of thinking about populations bound by complex and contradictory notions of loyalty and psychological investment. Based on meticulous archival research and oral histories, archipelago of resettlement, Vietnamese refugee settlers, and decolonization across Guam and Israel-Palestine, Gandhi is able to probe deeply into fascinating personal stories of refugees that have moved between these spaces. We also talk about her current book project, which tackles the idea of southern regions such as South Korea, South Vietnam, and the American South as each mourning lost images of the nation. We hope you enjoy this and other episodes. Please help support Speaking Out of Place by subscribing via our website, speakingoutofplace.com, following us on Instagram, and following me on Blue Sky. You can give me your feedback and suggest people to invite and topics to cover. Speaking Out of Place is made with support from Stanford University. I alone am responsible for its content. Thank you so much for being on the show. I wanted to talk to you first about your book, Archipelago of Resettlement, Vietnamese Refugee Settlers and Decolonization Across Guam and Israel-Palestine, and then ask about how your current work is continuing this kind of lateral trajectory of connecting places, peoples, and histories in new formations that seem to go against our habitual ways of identifying peoples as primarily members of nation states and areas. I think the first question listeners would be interested in is, how did you come to undertake such a study that would draw together Vietnamese refugee settlers, people in Guam, and people in Israel-Palestine? That's an amazing set of constituents, if you will. Yeah. How did this project happen?
Yeah. So this project started when I was in graduate school. I was doing my PhD in the rhetoric department at UC Berkeley. And I came into graduate school wanting to write more about Vietnamese refugee history and memory. Part of it was motivated by family background. So my mom and grandmother were Vietnamese refugees who left Vietnam in April 1975. They actually went through Guam as part of their refugee journey coming to California. So that connection was part of, you know, the personal history. But in terms of the how Israel-Palestine became a key site of the project as well, my first semester of graduate school, I took a class with Daniel Boyarin, and it was rhetoric and history, comparative diasporas. So we're thinking about Jewish diaspora and in particular Jewish diaspora critiques of Zionism, and also thinking about Black Atlantic diaspora as another way of organizing a people and a culture outside of, as you mentioned, but a strict nation state. And so I was like, how do I connect my interest in Vietnamese refugees and Vietnamese refugee diaspora? Stumbled upon this very small population of just a few hundred Vietnamese refugees who actually were granted asylum in the state of Israel in the late 1970s, and then even became Israeli citizens, which is a huge exception within Israeli immigration policy, which is if you are of Jewish descent, it's really easy to become an Israeli citizen. But if you're not, it's very difficult to do, including for, of course, Palestinians who are native to the region and to Palestine. And so I became acquainted with this poet, Van Wing, who I write about in the book, first through the film that I write about, The Journey of Van Wing, and then also through her poetry, and became a really interesting case study, I think, for opening up questions of refugee critiques of the nation state, as well as diaspora critiques of the nation state. And then I think another key point for me was also in teaching. For me, I think that research and teaching always go hand in hand. They always inform one another. So rhetoric had this really cool co-teaching model where you could teach with another rhetoric graduate student. So I co-taught a class on the rhetoric of translation with Ryan Radigan. And Ryan had gotten an MA in American Indian Studies actually before coming to rhetoric. Mm-hmm. And this was actually my first, I think, academic encounter with Indigenous Studies and Settler Colonial Studies, co-designing the syllabus with him. And it became really illuminating to me that, of course, settler colonial indigenous critique was a key frame that I needed to engage with as well, both in regards to Palestine, but also in regards to Guam. I think I always knew I wanted to do a relational comparative project. And so Guam or Guam also became a key site for the project. Again, as I mentioned, because of personal reasons, But also, I think I was very critical how a lot of Vietnamese American studies really focused on the continental U.S. in a way that just reinforces this primacy of the both the Continental 48, but also I think the 50 states more broadly as like the United States, that of course erases the kind of contemporary imperialness of the United States and its ongoing territories, including the territory of Guam. And so that contemporary erasure is reflected in that historical erasure of the importance of Guam in Vietnamese American refugee history in particular. So folks like the historian Jana Lippman have written about Guam and the repatriate case of Vietnamese refugees who ended up going back to Vietnam from Guam. And I wanted to add to the kind of historical work that she was doing, as well as follow up with Vietnamese Americans who are still there living in Guam and what's their relationship to the ongoing Chamorro decolonization struggle.
That's a great story because to me, it really emblematizes what is important to do when you're a scholar. In other words, it's so easy to go back to the same topics, the same subjects and dig deeper and to take comfort that you're nestled in this silo that's comfortable and people recognize it and all of a sudden you're part of this club. And you're also told, don't be personal. Don't bring in this bias that might skew you away from responsible scholarship. And what you and your teaching partner did was to really show us how following the actual interest that one has, no matter what the direction might be or what the outcome might be, actually is what creates really interesting scholarship, that breaks paradigms, that creates new fields. And one of the things that you figure on, again, and it takes up this idea of getting away from different kinds of spatial and political containers, is this really wonderful image of the archipelago. And the figure has a kind of poetic ambience, wherein spatially discontinuous places are brought into contact. But how you talk about it is based upon such really hard empirical data and political usages. In other words, you're not just talking about a fanciful image, but something that's concretized in very real ways. Could you talk a little bit about how you came upon this blend of empirical and, let's say, poetic and creative thinking about this term, this image, right?
Yeah, thank you. The concept of the archipelago came a little bit later in the project as I was trying to figure out, well, what is the method to bring all of these different spaces into relation, right? This is not a kind of IR comparative and contrast kind of thing. This is how it looks in this case study, and then it looks at this case study, right? But I wanted something more fluid. And I think it was also important for me to not just be the scholar who is isolated in the ivory tower and imposes this analytic on my case studies, but rather to really be in conversation with the communities that I am writing alongside and writing about, and to think about how their epistemologies can also inform the project in really important ways. And so the archipelago, I think, connects to each of the communities that the book grapples with. So first, in terms of Vietnamese epistemology, and in particular, Vietnamese refugee epistemology, the concept of nước is really important. So nước in Vietnamese means water, but it also is the term for country or homeland, right? And so I was really interested in this kind of non-binary opposition between land and water, and how can we think about home and homemaking and home finding in more fluid ways, right? In ways that kind of open up to more diasporic thinking, but also understands, I guess, the refugee passage is also one that was quite violent in a lot of ways and caused a lot of trauma, even though there is a lot of cultural flourishing that tries to grapple with that really intense history. The archipelago, of course, is also really important in terms of thinking about Chamorro kind of decolonial understandings of the Marianas. So Guam, of course, is an island, but even thinking about it as this island in U.S. territory kind of reinforces its political and rhetorical separation from the rest of the Chamorro Island, which now is the Commonwealth of Northern Mariana Islands. But of course, historically, there was much more. Historically, the whole archipelago was the home, and it still is, of the Chamorro people. And so thinking about how these years and years of colonization from the Spanish, the German, the Japanese, and the Americans have reinforced this political division. And so to take a kind of archaeologic frame is to decolonize, right, those centuries of colonial division. And then if we look to Israel-Palestine, of course, the water and bodies of water are very important. If you think about the scene from the river to the sea, so thinking about bodies of water as the kind of ways of envisioning a Palestine and a liberated Palestine. But then there's lots of critiques about how Palestinian self-determination in its very limited forms that we see of it now are very kind of archipelagic, right? So thinking about the archipelagic also as a critique of the way that Israeli state power is continually trying to divide the land of Palestine such that it makes it very hard on a basic level for people to see their friends and families, but on a more political level to organize as a continuous nation. I'm in conversation with folks like Sarah Emoud, who's theorizing Palestinian diaspora also as an archipelago. So really inspired by a lot of Palestinian feminist and diasporic scholars as well, who are trying to think about Palestinian liberation outside of a more kind of masculinist nationalist framework as well.
As somebody who grew up during the Vietnam War and has been active in pro-Palestinian activism for some time, and cognizant of how these wars are related, I was really fascinated by how you integrated Guam into your analytic. And I think most of our listeners would know less about Guam than anything else. So could you talk more about Guam and perhaps the elements that made your study different than maybe you had originally envisioned? And also, you had these wonderful oral histories coming out of Guam. Maybe if you could talk about a couple of them that really struck you as being, aha, this is really what makes sense in this broader analytic. These are the lies I need to get out there.
Yeah, that's a great question. One of the things I was trying to explore in the project broadly was how do Vietnamese refugees, particularly those who resettle and find a new home, how do they relate to the settler colonial policies of the state or the territory in which they are resettled? So for Guam, thinking about U.S. territory, Juliet Nabalin's concept of settler militarism is really helpful here because it's actually the U.S. military, both the Air Force and the Naval Base, who control what used to be over 50% of the island. Now it's closer to a third of the island's territory, though they still have a very strong political and spatial presence on the island. And as well, the conversation about Chamorro decolonization and Guam's status is a very active one in the contemporary politics in Guam, right? There is ongoing political movements to think about, okay, should Guam be its current status quo of a territory? Should it try to move towards statehood, try to move towards full political independence or something like a commonwealth? And so Guam is a very small island. Everyone knows each other. Communities and villages are very close to one another, both spatially as well as on the internet level. So Vietnamese Americans who live on Guam are a part of these conversations. They're very cognizant of them, right? So one of the things I tried to do in the oral histories was to think about and tease out the contours of what in the book I call the refugee settler condition, which is how do refugees relate to these decolonization movements and these on the grounds, everyday conversations that are happening about Guam's status, the role of Chamorro self sovereignty, self-determination, and trying to really unpack why Vietnamese Americans might feel a strong attachment or very sincere forms of gratitude towards the U.S. military, U.S. nation state, and how that kind of affinity for the U.S. military also retroactively justifies, right, the military occupation of Guam, but humanizes the military. I saw that a lot as well in newspaper articles. This is the time when the U.S. was trying to remake its image and say, we're not the loser of the Vietnam War, but actually we're going to win this humanitarian kind of PR war, right, by resettling and evacuating anti-communist Vietnamese refugees who aligned with the Southern Republic of Vietnam. I think actually the oral histories were one of the more difficult parts of the project for me. So I conducted a lot of them, both in Guam as well as in Israel-Palestine. But I actually didn't write about them as much in the dissertation. I had to take some time away and come back to the project and the revisions for the book when I was able to integrate them, I think, in a more ethical way. And part of it was, I think, in rhetoric, I was trained in this form of critique. So I knew how to critique state rhetorics. I knew how to critique this negative media representations of refugees, for example. And I was critical of the ways that I think these refugee communities were aligning with settler colonialism or internalizing it. But I also, as someone who comes from these communities, wanted to take seriously their kind of rationales and motivations. So how do you write about communities that you don't necessarily agree with politically, mm-hmm. but you want to try to just map out what are the kind of structural forces, or what I try to think about as structural antagonisms, that are pitting these communities against one another? So to try to do that on one level. But then also for me, it was really important to not end the conversation there and say, there are actually, coming from artists and writers of these communities, there are ways that people are envisioning what politically sometimes seems impossible, like an impossible coalition or impossible solidarity.
Just to give the listeners a sense of how granular these stories are, because we've talked previously about this expansive notion of the archipelago, but then some of these stories focus on things that really wonderfully combine an attention to the material and the affective. And you talk a lot about food, which is only natural because we're Asians. But you also talked about some really interesting films. Maybe you could talk about one of the films that to you really brought out so much of what you're talking about. And as you do, I want our listeners to understand that it really is such a wonderful model of the kind of scholarship that one should appreciate, because it breaks apart these categories, not just frivolously or randomly or through political motivation. You're responding to actual data and actual stories as well, through which people form senses of alliance, collective action, and also a sense of ethics. How do we act together? How do I act as a X or Y under these unforeseeable circumstances? But anyway, go ahead and please, any examples from that section would be wonderful.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you so much for the question. So I'll give you an example from the Guam side, and then I'll also give you an example from the Israel-Palestine side, which focuses more on the film. But the first figure that I want to introduce our listeners to is Bianca Wing. So I first came across Bianca's blog, I guess, in graduate school when I was first doing some research for this. So one of my interlocutors at the University of Guam said, oh, I taught a student a long time ago, Vietnamese American student. She was really interested in these Chamorro decolonization conversations around the vote about what Guam's status should be. And I think that she wrote a blog. And so he sent me the link to the blog and I read it. And it was really fascinating as a kind of undergraduate who's grappling with Guam's status and her role and just being very fascinated and learning more. I searched really hard for her. And actually, it was pretty late in the project that I was able to find her. So I was doing, this was, of course, before the book came out, but late stage revisions. I was doing maybe like a virtual conference presentation on this. And it was telling what I knew about Bianca's story and this blog. And then one of the audience members says, oh, I think I know her. And he says, have you tried looking under Bianca Wing? And gave me some contact information. I ended up finding her and we ended up having this really wonderful conversation. It turns out, as I suspected, that she is also of Chamorro descent on her mother's side, right? Mm-hmm. And so then I was also really thinking about, for someone who both embodies indigeneity as well as these refugee inheritances, I think that puts her in a very unique positionality to grapple with these questions of how does refugee identity and indigenous identity intersect in these kind of very vexed political questions that we're asking. And so thinking about her blog, both as a quotidian text that then followed up with a couple oral history interviews with her, and she then updated her blog maybe like 10, 15 years later. And her latest entry is actually about our conversation. Oh, so that was also an interesting way where this, what we might think of as a literary text or historical artifact, then changes as part of the kind of scholar interlocutor encounter. And so, yeah, she's a really wonderful person I'm still in contact with. I learned a lot from. The other figure that I want to mention was Van Wing, who's one of my main contacts and was also the first public figure that I was introduced to on the Vietnamese-Israeli side. So she was actually born in Ashkelon, so in the state of Israel, historic Palestine. Her mom and father were Vietnamese refugees who actually went through the Philippines and were waiting for resettlement in the Philippines for many months. Israel comes in 1979. They send an ambassador over who's very desperate to find people who would be willing to go to Israel. And I think for people who had in particular been waiting for months for asylum elsewhere, such as in Canada or in the United States or in France, they were running out of options. So her family was one that decided to accept this offer with about 200 others in terms of that particular wave. This was the third wave who were resettled in Israel. And she's one of, I think, four sisters. And she's also a poet, right? So one of the films that I actually watched early in my graduate career was The Journey of Van Wing. And initially, I wasn't sure I wanted to write about the film for the project because her poetry is very rich and complex. And of course, it's also, she has more authorial control or authorial intent over the poetry, which the documentary is made about her and her family. Though, of course, the director, Dookie Drawer, has a slightly different perspective than her, one could say, right, as the one who has, at the end of the day, the editorial control. And so there was a way that I think that the film kind of flattens her narrative to one of these perpetual foreigner, like, I don't feel at home in Israel, and I also don't feel at home in Vietnam. And that's the end of the story, without trying to problematize that or try to critique the kind of national forces that might make one feel that way, right? But later in my thinking, I realized this is actually a dual narrative, this film. It's as much a film about her as it is about her father, who was the one who experienced the refugee migration, is also himself a poet and a writer, and now works as a translator, among other things, in Israel. But it was a story about her father's journey back to Vietnam to reclaim his ancestral lands, right? And so this is the other part of refugee stories that's not always told, right? Sometimes we think about migration stories or refugee stories as being unidirectional from the homeland to the land of resettlement. And we don't always follow up the story to the question of return. And so there was an interesting resonance there with Palestinian struggles for the right of return. And I didn't want to conflate refugee narratives of trying to reclaim their homes with indigenous, but also Palestinian refugee narratives with wanting to reclaim their homes from which they were displaced. But I think there were also interesting political resonances that I was hoping would open up a conversation for Vietnamese Israelis, for whom sometimes it feels very difficult to think about and sympathize with Palestinian liberation struggles. This was a concrete experience that they could see parallels with, this desire to return to the lands and waters in which one's family had resided for generations, right? So in the film, he goes back and he points out the fields and the mountains that his family had been raised in. And of course, they were taken by the government and redistributed as part of the communist land redistribution after the end of the war. And so thinking about also ways that the Israeli government has appropriated land and redistributed them, and the ways that people can't come back. They have no legal claim anymore to the land in terms of Palestinian legal claims that are at least ones that are recognized by the new government in power. So it became a very powerful film for me to try to think through these glimpses of what decolonial solidarity might look like.
So I'll ask a typical question. Now that the book has been out for a while, you've put it aside. What's it like looking back at it? You know, how is your sense of it now that it's set into time, as it were? Yeah.
That's a good question. Two things I'll say, and again, related to the two sides of analysis. So in terms of Palestine, I think another kind of motivator for writing this book was when I was in grad school. Summer 2014 was another one of these kind of flare-ups of intensified violence, I guess we should say, alongside the slow violence of Palestinian dispossession. This was with another kind of summer of intense Israeli airstrikes on Gaza. It led to a lot of organizing on UC Berkeley's campus. It was my first kind of real on the grounds exposure to Palestinian organizing. And I think so that was a big kind of inspiration for writing the project and really trying to interrogate what is my particular positionality and how can I relate to this struggle? And so I was really interested in thinking about not only Vietnamese refugee Palestinian solidarity in the present, but what are historical antecedents of that? And so I think that, interestingly, the book, of course, is resonating again with the kind of post-October 7th and the intense Palestinian organizing that's happening across our campuses, and then the intense repression, not only across university campuses, but across the nation and around the world that we are witnessing. But I think one of the really wonderful things that I hadn't foreseen was how Vietnamese American students in particular have reached out to me and said, this book is such a resource for trying to think about my role in solidarity in an allyship with this struggle. Wow. That I think has been really wonderful to see, something that I wouldn't necessarily have predicted. The other thing that I'll say is that I do these public history exhibits that relate to, in particular, the Vietnam-Guam connections. And so we first did one in Guam. I was partnered with Guam Philharmonic Foundation to do a public history and exhibit in summer 2022. So this was just a couple months after the book had come out. And we featured a lot of the people that I did oral histories with, so both Vietnamese Americans who are living in Guam, as well as Chamorro Vietnam War veterans, which was the other kind of key population that I was thinking about. And that was really lovely because even though the book is open access, not everyone is going to read it, of course. It's an academic monograph at the end of the day. But it was really lovely to invite these interlocutors and narrators to come and have their family and friends come, and they see them on the walls. And we were also just in a mall space. So we had a lot of people going through who were like going to the Chili's next door and then would stop by our exhibit. And then another thing that we didn't predict was a lot of people got really inspired by what they saw, and they were like, oh, I have artifacts. And I have photographs in my closet.
Wow.
And because we weren't in an institutional space where everything was like fixed in stone, we could move things around and continually add to the exhibit and have it grow. So that was a really wonderful experience. We just opened our second version at UC Irvine. So the title of the new one is Remembering Saigon Journeys Through and From Guam. So partly to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the end of the Vietnam War, the fall of Saigon, but also the 50th anniversary of Operation New Life and the role that Guam played in to offer shelter and offer temporary as well as permanent refuge to Vietnamese refugees and Vietnamese Americans. So that was also a really wonderful experience because it's interesting to see how the stories change and also how the exhibit changes to be site specific. So we really wanted to draw from a lot of the primary materials of the Southeast Asian Archive that's down there at UC Irvine, highlight their materials, as well as both Chamorros, as well as Vietnamese Americans who have resettled in this Southern California region. We did a couple more oral history interviews, new ones that don't show up in the book, and feature them in the exhibit, as well as an online website that we have that's continually growing. It's nice. It feels like a living archive.
Yeah.
The book is not just a static thing.
Oh, perfect. Because the podcast website has a blog function. So please send me these links and we'll set up a blog so people can listen to this and then reference that. And I love the fact this being regenerated and reimagined constantly. That's a great testament to the importance of the topic. I'd like to move on to your new topic, which is equally ambitious and interesting and breaking new boundaries, which is on, largely speaking, the South, but in particular, South Korea, South Vietnam, and the Southern United States. Similar question. What got you interested in this? I can imagine all sorts of skeptics saying, this is arbitrary and this is an accident geography.
Yeah.
But again, as with your monograph, you support a lot of your theoretical assertions with really interesting and diverse sets of empirical and cultural data. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So broadly, as you mentioned, the project looks at South Vietnam, South Korea, and the U.S. South or the American South. I'm interested in the Southern connections or how we might theorize the South, not only as a region, but as a political concept, how the South is being defined vis-a-vis an imagined North, right? course, we have concepts of the global South versus the global North, and that how that kind of shorthand very easily identifies kind of global power dynamics and hierarchies. But I was also interested in these spaces that seem to not quite fit into the global South, right? Of course, the U.S. South is America as part of the global North. But then also thinking about South Vietnam and South Korea, if we look at Cold War history, they aligned with the United States. So they were not part of the North Korea-North Vietnam alliance that was finding all of these relations with places like Cuba, for example, and the Third World Solidarity. That was being articulated, right? Also with, of course, there were a lot of Asian American activists who were aligning themselves with Ho Chi Minh and what they saw as the Vietnamese decolonial struggle, right? So I think it was also trying to grapple with the historical formation of Asian American studies and how these spaces of and the diasporas that they produce, South Korean and South Vietnamese diasporas, how do we fit into this kind of intellectual field as well? And yeah, thinking about how the Korean War, in a lot of ways, was historical precedent for the Vietnam War. South Korea also then will send military folk to fight alongside or on behalf of the United States in South Vietnam, an ally with South Vietnam. And then also thinking about Black soldiers, many of whom trace, of course, their family histories to the U.S. South and the transatlantic slave trade. They were also agents of empire fighting the Korean War and the Vietnam War. And these early moments of desegregation, at least on the military front abroad, before kind of formal desegregation in the United States and on the homeland front. But this was also the project that the Colonel came about in graduate school. And it was one of those things that you put it aside to work on the dissertation. But my Vietnamese language instructor, who now actually teaches at Stanford, Bac Hoi Chen, one of the things that he was telling me was he and his cohort of friends, these older Vietnamese American gentleman who left when he was an adult, also really liked Gone with the Wind. So I thought there was something interesting there about kind of Southern nostalgia for a fallen Southern state or Southern government that was being translated into a South Vietnamese context, but also thinking about the stickiness of that inheritance and the alignment or intentional or not with kind of Confederate nostalgia and lost cause mythology. I think the other key moment was my best friends in graduate school, Rachel Lim, who teaches at CSU Sacramento now, was doing a lot of work on Korean diaspora and particularly Koreans in Mexico. So we talked a lot about also political conservatism and anti-communist inheritances in Korean American and Vietnamese American and diasporic communities more broadly, right? And what are the Cold War histories that inform that? So that kind of got me started thinking about a lot of the parallels between U.S. intervention in Korea and in Vietnam and how those histories are talked about or not talked about in American historiography. Then I think another flashpoint for me was the January 6th Capitol riot, which, of course, is now unfortunately in the news all again now, and all these pardons that are happening. Vietnamese Americans showed up in mass, actually, at the protests and were waving their South Vietnamese flags, Republic of Vietnam flags, and of course seeing juxtapositions with not only Trump flags, American flags, but also Confederate flags that were at that protest as well, or at the riot. And that, I think, led to a lot of reckoning in 2016 and onwards about within the Vietnamese American community of what is leading to these juxtapositions very intimately and spatially, right? Is there a political unconscious here that we need to grapple with?
As you illuminated part of my family history in a way I've never thought of before. And this might be totally frivolous, but I don't think so. I think it's highly motivated. My father was from southern China and grew up in Hawaii. And he joined the Chinese Nationalist Army, fought the Japanese, fought on the side of the Allies, and was a staunch Republican. And one of his favorite artifacts was a signed letter from Richard Nixon, that kind of stuff, right?
My
mother's from Beijing, so Northerner. And she came to grad school at Radcliffe and, long story short, got to know Eleanor Roosevelt. So staunch liberal. Yeah. And they used to laugh about how they would constantly negate each other's votes.
Yeah.
But So interesting. How
yeah,
did
interesting
you?
Interesting north south dynamic there.
Yeah,
within
you can
your
find it any place. Yeah, you've started as something what can cascade into this huge global thing. But I do think that geography matters. But I think even more importantly, perhaps, is exactly what you've tapped into. And you actually anticipated a question I had, which was the relationship between, in your monograph, what you discuss as the settler refugee condition and this nostalgia for lost unity and for this lost wholeness that you find because, and you also cite the famous Gramsci essay, because you have this breaking apart of Northern and Southern political economies, right? So you have a kind of advance of industrialization in the North, and of course the South feels that it's always behind that a little bit. Could you talk a little bit about Gramsci?
Yes, I think that another way to think about these three spaces is they are all kind of post-Civil War spaces, right? As you mentioned, thinking about this internal war between the North and the South and these, you know, spaces that understood themselves as a whole or as a national community that have to then grapple with this very intense political division and brother killing brother, family against family. That we see, of course, in the U.S. Civil War, but then also in the Korean War. And of course, the Korean Peninsula is still divided. Technically, the Korean War is still unending. And then also in the Vietnam War, which I think, at least in the United States, we forget was also a civil war, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's a yep. way that South Vietnamese agency and South Vietnamese history gets erased, both in Vietnam as the losers of the war, right? They're written off as traitors or puppets to the U.S. government. And then in the U.S., of course, it's like the binary between the U.S. as the liberators and Vietnam as the bad communists. That kind of erases what was the South Vietnamese kind of political division and how can we take it seriously while not also falling into kind of a different kind of nostalgic nationalism, which can be very dangerous in its own ways, as we see with the January 6th stuff that happened. I think Gramsci was another key interlocutor. So his essay, thinking about the Southern question and thinking about Southern politics. And so it's a helpful framework for me in two respects. One, I think I was intrigued by the way he saw Southern Italy as politically illegible in a lot of ways mm-hmm. to existing, like more economically oriented Marxist frameworks, right? Mm-hmm. Of course, the North, Northern Italy, which is much more urban, follows the kind of proletarian revolutionary model more than the South, which had an agrarian economy. Right? The kind of agrarian poor were seen as, oh, are they just going to reproduce the kind of agrarian elites kind of politics? Or is there a way that they can form unexpected alliances, mm-hmm. right, with kind of radical organizing in the North? And it was a moment of contingency in which he was writing, where it could go either way. And so I was also intrigued both by this illegibility sometimes of South Korea and South Vietnam and the U.S. South, as spaces of, in very simplified terms, kind of conservatism, right? Seen as outside of global South politics, if we understand that is to be more leftist oriented, more third world solidarity oriented. But what I'm really interested in at the end of the day, which is I think a holdover from the first project, is difficult solidarities, right? And how do we imagine them? And of course, the underlying conversation for this project is anti-Blackness within Asian American broadly, but also I think Korean American, Vietnamese American communities and how that's corresponding to these different Southern alliances and uncanny Southern connections. But can we think about taking seriously the Southern inheritances of these South Korean migrant and South Vietnamese refugee communities, but route it through a different Southern kind of legacy in the U.S. context, particularly for people who resettled here, right? So instead of this nostalgia for the Confederate South, is there a way that we can route it through kind of Black legacies of resistance in the U.S. South and thinking about these other Southern legacies that take seriously the specificity of a Southern political identity as a holdover of a post-Civil War framework, but then can lead to, these unexpected solidarity.
You anticipated my last question, which was,
on a flow.
Yeah. What pieces need to fall in place for you to feel like the project is, okay, this is where I want it. What's the future work on this project? Because it's so important, so interesting.
Yeah. I'm in the midst of writing it. This is I think everybody struggles with this as the kind of associate professor, but writing the second mm-hmm. book is very different than writing the first. There's no kind of structure of grad school and the dissertation committee. But aside from that, this project is, I think I envision it now as a cultural studies project. So really looking at art and literature and film for grappling, with this kind of political subconscious of the South and how these cultural producers are envisioning and articulating these Southern connections between spaces, but also seeing my role as a kind of curator, or I'm playing with the term constellation and constellate. So constellating these spaces together and constellating these artists and writers together to try to think about these three spaces in juxtaposition and what does that open up for us. I think it's a dual process of always being on the lookout for new cultural texts that can help me think through this question and then grappling with them. So I'll tell you right now, I'm deep in Faulkner studies and really interested in how, like a couple of Vietnamese American short stories, why these kind of Southern intertextual citations of Faulkner. And the other film that I'm looking at is Dong's Korean film, Burn, which is a citation of a Murakami short story, Burning, which references Faulkner's story, Barnes Burning. Why are we citing Faulkner here as a kind of course, a canonical Southern American text, and what rhetorical and literary and political work, are those kind of intertextual citations doing?
It's funny that you mentioned the difficulty of writing a second book as a tenured professor, because I was just last week, I had a lunch with Kate Wall, who was an editor at Stanford Press, and we were talking about, once you get tenure, you're tempted to think, no, I have all the time in the world. And I was reminding her that when I turned in my second book, which is the Asian American book, it was 1,000 pages typescript. Mm-hmm. And people are still amazed that Stanford actually published it. And I regret having written such a long book. So my advice to you is, don't take forever. We need this out in the world. You'll write a third or fourth or fifth book, but it's an amazing project, as is your first one. So thank you so much for being on the show. It's been wonderful talking with you.
Thank you so much for the wonderful questions.